think about how much time you spend on your phone or a computer every day. Then think about how much you know about the code that makes everything work. Computer programmers or coders have a lot of influence on our lives, from our medical records to social media to the innards of our cars and appliances. But who are they, and what do they actually do? Clive Thompson is a journalist who writes about science and technology. He's a contributing writer for the New York Times Magazine, a monthly columnist for Wired Magazine, and writes a periodic column about the history of technology for Smithsonian Magazine. His new book is Coders, The Making of a New Tribe and the Remaking of the World. Clive, welcome back to Central Time.
It's good to be here.
Well, talk about coders. It's this job that's, as you write, incredibly influential in our lives and yet largely invisible to us. It's kind of a weird combination.
It really is. I mean, when you think about it, there's almost nothing you can do these days outside of maybe like taking a walk in the woods that does not use software, right? You know, you wake up, you know, you look at your phone, check your email. You know, every time you're in your car, it's basically like a thing run by software now. And, you know, payroll, GPS, everything. Software essentially has become the operating system for the way we live. And so what that means is the people that write it and the people that, you know, get an idea for something new, you know, like, hey, you know, I've got this idea for this crazy Facebook thing, or, you know, I have this idea for this Instagram thing or this Google thing. Those people have an enormous amount of power on how we live our lives because they create, you know, they create new abilities. They let us do things that we couldn't do before. Sometimes they make it so much fun to do it that we do it a ton. And that's why I sometimes think of software developers as, you know, kind of the unacknowledged legislators of reality right now.
You've done some coding yourself, and you spend a lot of time in your book watching people at work, interviewing them. For those of us who haven't done it, I mean, what does the job of a coder look like?
Well, you know, if you were to look at a movie or a TV show, often you'd see someone, you know, if they were a coder sitting there, and they're just typing all the time, and like they're just typing and the code is flowing out of them. That is not even remotely what coding is actually like, because when you're coding, what you're doing is it's really just taking a complicated thing that you have to do, like, you know, I don't know, take this photo that I posted and look for any faces in it and identify them and send those names out to a different place. It's breaking everything down step by step by step, painfully minute steps. You have to be very specific. And when you're writing those instructions out in software, if you make the slightest error, everything stops working. So it's really easy to make mistakes. And so a lot of coding is actually someone writing like 4 or 5 lines of code or 10 lines of code and checking to see, okay, did this one little thing that I tried to get the computer to do, does this one little thing work? And 9 times out of 10, it doesn't. Like, there's already something you've done wrong because you haven't thought through carefully every little step, or maybe you even just made a stupid typo, like you put a comma in the wrong place. And these things break software. So a lot of coding is really sitting there with something broken and trying to fix it and just staring at the screen, baffled and being unbelievably frustrating. That's what coding is kind of like.
It sounds like there's a love-hate relationship. And you quote someone, I'm going to clean up the language here, but someone who says, all right, think of coding and working with a computer as working with an amazing jerk all day who basically, if you don't tell it exactly what you want him or her to do, they're going to get it wrong. And that can wear on a person, it sounds like.
Oh, my God. Yeah, absolutely. I mean, this is a thing, like, you know, if you talk to a developer who has been, you know, grinding away for hours and hours, and sometimes if you're really trying to get in there deep, you know, you're at it for 5, 10, 15 hours, when they come away from that, they have been dealing with the most linear, the most prissy, grammatically, you know, focused, picky, you know, annoying colleague, the computer. And it kind of, you know, a lot of them told me it can kind of rub off on you, right? Like, you know, if you get someone right at the end of a big bug hunt, they can be, you know, very, you know, pissy and kind of, you know, linear and, you know, and kind of like, you know, oh, you didn't say that exactly correctly. I'm not going to answer your damn question, because that's kind of what they were doing for the last 10 hours. Right. You know, it rubs off on you.
Talking to Clive Thompson about his new book, Coders, The Making of a New Tribe and the Remaking of the World, about the people who write the software that shapes our lives, even often if we don't notice it. Well, to that point, Clive, you look at stereotypes of computer programmers and their personalities. Is there a modal coder? Is there a coding personality?
Yeah, there's definitely some strong commonalities. Here's what you typically find, and what I found when I talked to like about 200 of these developers over the last couple of years. One is that they're all really good at thinking logically, at breaking those complicated things down into little pieces. Amazing at doing that type of thing. Second thing is, they're very meticulous. They have to be, you know, so, and they're meticulous often, not always, but very frequently in other ways too. Like, they're precise in the way they communicate, right? And they can be annoyed when someone is not precise in the way they communicate. They're really good at dealing with frustration. They have to be, right? You know, like, if you're going to deal with bugs all day long, you're going to be like that. But here's one of the surprises. This one is interesting. This one came up over and over again. They are very, impressed by and excited by efficiency, taking something that is happening in a slow or ponderous way and speeding it up, or taking something that involves a lot of really boring, repetitive work and automating it so the computer does it for you. They do that so much in their jobs. That's what a lot of software is. It's really taking something that's, you know, kind of being done by humans and saying, no, let's have the computer do this, because they're much faster and they're much more regular and much more precise. They do that so much that it starts to become almost offensive when they're presented with something that's inefficient. Like, it becomes like I think of it like an aesthetic, like things that are done by hand or repetitively are almost like gross to them. Like, why would you do that when you have these computers that can do this stuff? So they become very, very swept up with and excited by, in almost a spiritual way, with efficiency.
And that can have a downside. You write that it's a virtue in programming itself, but there's an almost chilling example. There was a coder you talked to who said, people kept bugging me. You never call, you never write. So he came up with a computer program to periodically randomly email someone with a series of stock phrases randomly chosen to make it look like he was reaching out, and he was doing it really efficiently. It seems like there's a downside there somewhere, Clive.
Totally. I mean, like, and, you know, developers themselves would say this to me. They say, like, you know, look, one of the problems is that, you know, I spend all my time thinking about how to torque things and make them more efficient and get rid of repetitive actions. And the problem is a lot of social activity, like a lot of, you know, us just being decent humans to each other, involves a lot of these very repetitive rote statements. Hey, how are you doing? You know, what's up? How's the weather? You know, these are this is sort of social glue, and we sort of expect it from each other, but it can start to become to a certain type of developer, not all of them, but quite a few of them, that becomes almost something that's annoying in and of itself. And I think you look at the problems that social software, you know, like social networks, Twitter or Facebook or whatnot, when you look at the problems that they have posed for the world, for the civic world, a lot of it, I think, ultimately has to do with the fact that those were all attempts to take human socializing and make it radically faster and more efficient, right? You know, that is how Mark Zuckerberg talked about Facebook. He talked about it as, I want to increase information flows. Like, I want to speed up the flow of how much we know about what everyone else is doing and thinking. And it turns out that can be really great in a lot of ways, but it can have some fantastic side effects that I think society is now grappling with.
Now, a story that runs through your book is the idea of who the type of person is who goes into computer programming when it comes to gender and race. And mostly we have the stereotype, and I think the numbers bear it out, white men, some Asian men. But it wasn't, you write, always that way. Women were dominant in the early days of coding and software in a lot of ways.
That's exactly right. In the very early days of coding, like the late 50s and the early 60s, when you first started seeing these big room-sized machines come out of the lab and out of the university and into large corporations who began using them for everything from payroll to data analysis, it was a surprisingly meritocratic period. No one knew how to code. There was no classes you could take in it. So when they had to hire coders, they didn't have any mental image of who a coder might be. They just sort of took anyone who was interested in proving that they were good at logic puzzles, you know, basically, and then they would train them on the job. And so it was a very open door, and a lot of women were coders, were very, very elite coders. In fact, something on the order of 1 in 4 programmers in 1960 were women, which is astonishing when you consider how sexist that period was in every other way. Like, they were certainly not 1 in 4 doctors or 1 in 4 mechanical engineers or anything like that. But this was a very, very open door. And that closed over time. That got worse. I mean, in 2013, which is the most recent figures I have, the net percentage of women in coding is actually slightly less than in 1960. It was 26%, which is amazing, because every other technical field just saw sort of a steady increase of women. Coding is one of the few ones that actually went backwards.
And one consequence of that, you write, that a lot of people are concerned about, is that if you don't have a mix of different people from different backgrounds in the room coming up with plans, you don't think about how things might affect different people. So without women in the planning stages of, say, Twitter, people weren't worried about the horrific harassment that quickly emerged on Twitter.
Right, exactly right. I mean, any Harvard Business Review study would sort of bear out the fact that if you have a complicated problem you're dealing with, particularly a social problem, you want to have people from a lot of different walks of life in the room brainstorming it, you know, because that's how you're going to make sure you solve for all these, what in software you would call all these edge cases of possible things that can go wrong. That was not at all the case in the early days of social software. It was a lot of young white guys in the room. By that point in time, software had become a lot of young white guys. And the young is actually also an issue too, right? Like, you know, if they'd had some developers in their 40s and 50s around, they could have said, you know, whoa, youngsters, you know, back in the 90s, we had discussion groups, and they often turned into crap storms of harassment. So if you're going to build this thing called Twitter, that's great, but let's get ahead of this problem. So some of the problem is not just they didn't have any women, they didn't even have any people, middle-aged people. Like, you know, Silicon Valley is very ageist too, right? You know, like, even if you're sort of a male programmer, by the time you're in your 40s and 50s, you're often shoved at the pasture. So the fact that they had this very small group of people who had really no or very little experience of being asked on meant that they, the folks in Twitter and to a certain extent Facebook too, and many other social networks, sort of didn't think to deal with it. And that's one of the reasons why they were caught flat-footed years later, and why they're still kind of trying to figure out how to deal with it. Because if you create a social network that's based on everyone openly talking to everyone all the time as your base structure, it's going to be pretty hard if you haven't mapped out some war games, some of those problems, to deal with it a decade on.
We continue our conversation with Clive Thompson, science and technology journalist writing for The New York Times Magazine and elsewhere. His new book is called Coders, The Making of a New Tribe and the Remaking of the World. We're talking about the people who make the software that shapes so much of our lives. You can join in at 800-642-1234. If you're a coder, a programmer yourself, we'd love to hear from you about what you do, what it's like, what the job light is like, and what you wish people knew about it. Or if you have a question about how all this stuff works, call 800-642-1234 or email ideas@wpr.org. Let's go to a caller now. Robbie is with us in Apple River, Illinois. Robbie, hi.
Hello. Can you boys hear me okay?
Sure. What did you want to ask about, Robbie?
I was just wondering, how soon does he think AI will alleviate their job requirements and positions, much like they are developing systems that are alleviating other people's jobs?
Interesting. So when can we have computers that program computers, Clive, I guess?
That's a great question, and one that a lot of programmers worry about, right? Because, you know, they sit around thinking, you know, I'm a lot of coding. It requires great insight and great hard work. But there is some rote activity in there, right? You know, and you could automate that. So the short answer is, I think over the next few years, we will probably see AI assisting quite a lot with programming. They're already working on developer tools that let you, you know, start, you know, mapping out what you want to do and having it auto suggest or auto complete some stuff that could move you along a lot more quickly. But I think we're probably still, you know, at least a decade or maybe more out from being able to fully you know, have an AI create something that is complicated. So I think developers are safe for some time.
Thanks for that call, Robbie. We go now to Cody in Madison. Cody, hello.
Hi.
What do you want to bring up, Cody?
I just had a comment about coding, and it was the fact that it's hard to get people to understand what you're doing with a computer by typing in, like, a, you know, we're typing in human language, and the machine's just compiling it, and it's a binary. So it's quite hard, the translation, to see what's going on there.
Cody, go ahead.
Also, the differences in the way different program interfaces call things, such as like functions, methods, whatnot. A lot of the things are the same, but they call them different things with different programs, if that makes sense.
Cody, thanks a lot for the call. And Clive, I know people write, they program in a lot of different programming languages. I understand there are very heated debates that I can't follow about which is best for which purpose. This is a big deal for coders.
It's true, actually. Well, you see, here's the thing. See, this is the thing that's sort of interesting and I think kind of, you know, neat about coding languages is that on the one hand, they're very similar. They're all kind of basically telling, you know, allow you to say, if this, then do that, right? You know, if this or whatnot. They all are good at some things and bad at others. So a lot of coders will gravitate towards certain languages because they sort of find it fits their, I don't know, it fits their intellectual hand like a glove, and they love it. But, you know, you will get some really serious holy wars over which languages are, quote unquote, the best. If you want some glimpse of that, go to a website for coders like Stack Overflow. And type in, does JavaScript suck? And just behold the fascinating arguments around that language, which is used inside browsers.
Thanks for that call, Cody. We're talking about the book Coders, The Making of a New Tribe and the Remaking of the World. Author Clive Thompson is with us. Back to your calls now. Curtis is on the line in Waukesha. Curtis, hi.
Hi.
Go ahead, Curtis. What did you want to tell us about?
So I'm a student in software engineering right now, graduating next year, and something I've noticed is that anybody who talks to me about what I'm learning about, like I'll say, oh yeah, I do programming or something, their first reaction is always, oh, I could never do that. And I have a completely different opinion about most people, because I think anybody who's intelligent, they're able to understand the concepts. They just put it on this other mental level thinking that they could never actually do it. But I think they can, and I just think there's so many more people who would love to code if they just didn't separate themselves from being able to do it.
Curtis, thank you so much for that call. And Clive, I want to point toward the last chapter in your book. Part of that chapter, you talk about a project in, I think it was Kentucky, trying to get coal miners into the world of coding.
Yeah, that caller, Curtis, is absolutely correct. There is a sort of mystique around coding that makes it seem like it's something that, you know, mere mortals could never get. Not at all true. Anyone who likes to be meticulous and is willing to do the hard work, I think, can learn this. In fact, you know, I myself, like I'm a journalist. I did some coding when I was a kid. I didn't really pursue it in my 20s and 30s. In my 40s, when I started working on this book, I decided I was going to learn a little bit more. And, you know, I've learned a whole bunch that's really useful in my job. These guys down in Kentucky, they're miners, and they wanted to create some sort of work that was not going to collapse the way mining was. So they created a software firm, and they got a senior programmer to come in and train 11 of them. They all picked it up absolutely great. I mean, as the leader of this company, Rusty Justice, told me, he said, look, you know, coal miners already deal with a lot of technology down there in the mines. They're patient. They have to be. They have to sit there for 10 hours in a mine. They have to solve problems. And so I interviewed these guys, and they were all like, yeah, I mean, it was hard, but, like, mining's hard, too. Like, everything's hard. If you are someone who can work and persist and just get through the frustration, you absolutely can learn coding.
In our last minute, Clive, what are you hoping people take away when you lift the veil into the world of coding?
Well, I actually think that I would like to see a little bit less mystique around it, exactly along the lines of what Curtis is talking about, for two reasons. One is I think it will make everyone slightly more informed in thinking about the reason that the modern world works the way it does. You know, it'll make them hopefully a little more usefully skeptical about the claims of software companies, maybe make them a little excited about the possibilities of things that could be done that aren't being done. And for the subset of people who are interested in maybe trying it out themselves, I absolutely would encourage them, because I think that there's something also artful and creative and fun in this discipline that I tried to evoke in the book, too.
Clive, thanks a lot for joining us today.
I had a great time.
We've been talking to journalist Clive Thompson. His latest book is called Coders, The Making of a New Tribe and the Remaking of the World. If this is you, if you're a coder or just getting into it now, let us know your story. Tweet us at Central Time WPR or send us an email, ideas@WPR.org.